on the Nixon committee were scheduled to testify. Jeb Magruder, Bart Porter, Rob Odle, and Hugh Sloan. Woodward went to listen and spotted Magruder pacing the corridors. The tall, 38-year-old former merchandiser of cosmetics, facial tissues, and women's hosiery had an American flag in the lapel of his conservative suit. Magruder looked at his watch and approached Silbert. "Earl," he said, "how much longer do I have to wait?" Silbert smiled deferentially and said something about courts not being run to meet the schedules of witnesses. Magruder was exasperated. At that point, Gordon Liddy walked past him and saluted, a big grin on his face. Reporters in the hallway laughed. Magruder became angrier and turned and walked back down the hall. Woodward decided that it was time to meet Magruder. He went up and introduced himself. Magruder was friendlier than he'd expected. "I have only one objection to what you and that fellow Bernstein did. That is, these visits you paid to some of my people at night, banging on their doors late and not identifying yourselves." Woodward said that he and Bernstein had always identified themselves and were always courteous. "Dirty reporting," Magruder said. "Now, it may not have been you, but Bernstein did, I know." Always the politician, Woodward thought. Magruder was not willing to confront him, but passed it off on Bernstein, who wasn't there. Woodward said that visiting people after working hours was not dirty at all, and was necessitated by the unwillingness of Magruder and dozens of other people to answer questions about Watergate. Magruder turned to walk away and then looked back to Woodward. "It's none of your business," he said, summarizing CRP's point of view. Silbert put Magruder through 33 minutes of tame, respectful questioning. Magruder testified that, as John Mitchell's first assistant, he was so busy supervising 25 campaign division heads and 250 full-time employees and spending between $30 and $35 million that he just couldn't be overly concerned with Gordon Liddy. Magruder said he didn't even get along with Liddy. Liddy had a different management style. Magruder said it as if a disagreement over management styles was the most serious thing that could ever come between two people, though Liddy had once threatened to kill him. Liddy sat rocking back and forth in his chair while Magruder spoke. Hugh Sloan, former Nixon campaign treasurer, walked nervously into the courtroom and took the stand. He looked even thinner. "He's down to skin and bones," his mother told a reporter from the New York Times. Silbert's perfunctory questioning was cold and distant. Sloan said that he had paid out about $199,000 in cash to Liddy. Silbert did not ask who had ordered Sloan to hand out the money. After Silbert finished his interrogation, Sirica sent the jury from the courtroom and asked Sloan 41 questions of his own. To one, Sloan replied that he had been worried about the large disbursements to Liddy, so he had checked with Maurice Stans, who in turn had verified the expenditures with John Mitchell, who in turn had said that Liddy should be given the cash. "You verified it with whom?" Sirica asked. Sloan repeated his answer. Before completing his questioning, Sirica made it clear he didn't believe Sloan's testimony that he had given out so much money without asking the purpose of the expenditures. Amazed at Sloan's apparent naivete, Sirica asked, "You're a college graduate, aren't you?" Several weeks later, in a post-trial hearing, Sirica would say flatly that he didn't believe Sloan had been truthful. But he had picked on the wrong person. Sloan was the one CRP witness who had cooperated fully with the investigation. Sirica didn't ask a single question of Magruder or Bart Porter, the CRP scheduling director. Both would later acknowledge committing perjury at the trial. During Silbert's closing argument, Liddy sat in his chair rocking slowly, a smile on his face, as the prosecutor pictured him as the Mr. Big of Watergate. Liddy, the ex-FBI agent, the former prosecutor who had made a career of cops and robbers. This time the cop had turned robber. Silbert paused, obviously pleased with the sound of his words. Liddy gave a quick, animated wave to the jury, exactly like the one he had given the first day of the trial. It took the jury less than 90 minutes to find Liddy and McCord guilty of all counts against them. Liddy stood impassive, with his arms folded defiantly, as the court clerk read the jury's verdict, repeating the guilty 6 times. McCord stood stoically as the word was pronounced 8 times, once for each count. Sirica ordered both jailed without bond. Before he was escorted out of the courtroom, Liddy embraced his attorney, Peter Maroulis, patting him on the back affectionately, and gave one last wave to the spectators and the press before he was taken away. Bernstein and Woodward wrote a lengthy news analysis summarizing the trial. Under the headline, "Still Secret, Who Hired Spies and Why?" they noted that the 16-day trial was marked by questions that were not asked, answers that were not given, witnesses who were not called to testify, and some lapses of memory by those who were. The reporters were convinced that the prosecutors hadn't thrown the case. More likely, they had been lied to. They had fallen victim to the subtle pressures exerted through the White House and Justice Department. Most of all, they had failed to understand the workings of CRP and the White House and the style of the president's men. 3 days after the verdict, Judge Sirica held a hearing in his courtroom and set bond for Liddy and McCord at $100,000 each. He sternly criticized Silbert. "I have not been satisfied, and am still not satisfied, that all the pertinent facts that might be available, I say, might be available, have been produced before an American jury." Defending his own conduct, he said, "I don't think we should sit here like nincompoops. I'll put it this way. I have great doubts that Mr. Sloan has told us the entire truth in this case. I will say it now, and I indicated that during the trial. I felt that neither of you, government or defense, asked Mr. Sloan any questions. I had a right to question him to see that all the facts were brought out. Everyone knows that there's going to be a congressional investigation in this case. I would frankly hope, not only as a judge, but as a citizen of a great country, and one of millions of Americans who are looking for certain answers, I would hope that the Senate committee is granted the power by Congress by a broad enough resolution to try to get to the bottom of what happened in this case. I hope so. That is all I have to say." Chapter 12. Now, Woodward needed to signal Deep Throat for a meeting. Shortly after the election, he had moved from his cramped efficiency apartment to a two-bedroom flat in a restored building 2 blocks from the post. He had told Deep Throat at their last meeting that the new apartment had no balcony for the flower pot and flag. Worse, the neighbors said that people were forever having their newspapers taken from in front of their doors. Woodward had taken the apartment only after he had thoroughly inspected the building's less obvious assets. Back stairways, fire exits, and windowsills. A new signal system was adopted at the end of the unhappy meeting on Haldeman. It would be a one-way communication, initiated by Woodward, who would place his yellow kitchen waste paper basket upside down on the fire escape. But the system hadn't even been tested before serious problems developed. Woodward's upstairs neighbors liked to dance, often between 1 and 4 a.m. He banged on the thin ceiling with a broom handle and begged his new neighbors to consider at least a sock hop, but that only rallied the nocturnal dancers. He wasn't superstitious, but he did believe that in a person's life there were bad cycles, which had to be forcefully arrested. His tailspin had begun with the Haldeman story. The frustrations had built during November and December. Better to move than tempt fate further. So the only time he had turned the trash basket upside down was in late December, and only to tell Deep Throat that he was moving again. Deep Throat was uncommunicative at their brief meeting, advising him to sit tight and see how the Watergate trial developed. Woodward found a new apartment on the top floor of a high-rise temple of formica and parquet luxury in southwest Washington, near the Potomac. He got himself a new flower pot and was back in business. Service was inaugurated on January 24th, after Woodward had spent several delicious nights reveling in the silence of his new quarters. He went through a basement exit into a rear courtyard and over a wall onto a side street, mindful of Mrs. Graham's warning about surveillance and Deep Throat's increasing apprehension. It took him a half hour to find a cab, and when he got about half a mile from the garage, the driver didn't have change for a $10 bill. Angrily, he told the hack to keep the $10. Deep Throat was waiting. He looked worn, but was smiling. "What's up?" he asked, mock offhandedly, and took a deep drag on his cigarette. Just once, Woodward wished, Deep Throat would really tell him what was up. Everything. No questions asked, no tug of wills, a full status report. The reporters had speculated on the reason for Deep Throat's piecemeal approach. They had several theories. If he told everything he knew all at once, a good plumber might be able to find the leak. By making the reporters go elsewhere to fill out his information, he minimized his risk. Perhaps. But it was equally possible that he felt that the effect of one or two big stories, no matter how devastating, could be blunted by the White House. Or, by raising the stakes gradually, was he simply making the game more interesting for himself? The reporters tended to doubt that someone in his position would be so cavalier toward matters affecting Richard Nixon or the presidency itself. More likely, they thought, Deep Throat was trying to protect the office, to effect a change in its conduct before all was lost. Each time Woodward had raised the question, Deep Throat had gravely insisted, I have to do this my way. That night it was the familiar pattern. He would respond only to new information. He would not be towed on a fishing expedition about the plumbers, the guilty pleas in the trial, or the riddles of Z. Afraid he would leave the garage empty-handed, Woodward turned to a subject he and Bernstein were about to write on, Mitchell and Colson. He quickly reviewed the strains of circumstantial detail that seemed to bring the two men close to the conspiracy. Deep Throat seemed impressed by the groundwork they had done. Suddenly he walked to the front of one of the cars in the garage and, standing erect, placed his gloved hands authoritatively on the hood as if it were a rostrum. From this podium, I'm prepared to denounce such questions about Gentle Colson and Noble Mitchell as innuendo, character assassination, hearsay, and shoddy journalism. The questions themselves are fabrication and fiction and a pack of absurdities and cometh from the fountain of misinformation. Woodward, who was very tired, started laughing and couldn't stop. Deep Throat Ziegler continued the denunciation. That small Georgetown coterie of self-appointed guardians of public mistrust who seek the destruction of the people's will. The levity was interrupted by a noise. Deep Throat ducked behind a car. Woodward walked up the ramp guardedly. A very convincing old drunk was leaning against the wall, shivering. Woodward made sure he was real, then gave him a $10 bill and told him to find a hotel room. It was brutally cold. Woodward returned to the lower level. The interruption had unnerved Deep Throat. Colson and Mitchell were behind the Watergate operation, he said quickly. Everyone in the FBI is convinced, including Gray. L. Patrick Gray, acting director of the FBI. Colson's role was active. Mitchell's position was more amoral and less active, giving the nod but not conceiving the scheme. There isn't anything that would be considered as more than the weakest circumstantial evidence, but there's no doubt either. Insulation is the key word to understand why the evidence can't be developed. He outlined four factors that might lead to the inescapable conclusion that Mitchell and Colson were conspirators. One, the personalities and past performance of both. This way of life wasn't new to them. Two, there are meetings and phone calls at crucial times, all of which Colson and Mitchell claim involved other matters. Three, there's the tight control of the money, especially by Mitchell, who was getting details almost to the point of how much was spent on pencils and erasers. Four, there is the indisputable fact that the seven defendants believe they are going to be taken care of. That could only be done convincingly by someone high up, and somehow it has been done convincingly. How sweeping was the belief that Colson and Mitchell were involved? No disagreement anywhere, Deep Throat said. The White House knows it. The FBI brass knows it. He rubbed his neck and moved the palm of his hand upward across the stiff bristle on his chin. Involved up to here. The hand went up higher. But it's still unproven. If the FBI couldn't prove it, I don't think the Washington Post can. What obviously makes this a Mitchell-Colson operation is the hiring of Liddy and Hunt. That's the key. Mitchell and Colson were their sponsors. And if you check, you'll find that Liddy and Hunt had reputations that are the lowest. The absolute lowest. Hiring these two was immoral. They got exactly what they wanted. Liddy wanted to tap the New York Times, and everybody knew it. And not everybody was laughing about it. Mitchell, among others, liked the idea. The Los Angeles Times had reported earlier that Liddy had suggested to White House colleagues that the New York Times be wiretapped to learn how it obtained the Pentagon Papers. According to the L.A. Times account, Liddy's suggestion had been dismissed out of hand on grounds that he was either crazy or kidding. Deep Throat became contemplative. Liddy and McCord should realize that no one can help them because it will be too obvious. Any congressional investigation is going to have a big problem unless they get someone from the inside to crack. Without that, you come up with lots of money and plans for dirty tricks, but no first-hand account or detailing of what happened at the top. The White House, he said, was developing plans to make sure no congressional investigation could succeed. Part of the strategy would involve a broad claim of executive privilege to prevent investigators from subpoenaing White House and Justice Department records. What about manipulation of the original Watergate investigation? The attempts to separate the Watergate and the espionage sabotage operation are a lot of bullshit, Deep Throat said. They amount to the same thing. If the other stuff, like Segretti, had been pursued, they would have found plenty that was illegal. Woodward asked if Deep Throat thought the reporters had enough for a story on Mitchell and Colson. That's for the paper to decide, not me, he said. But if you do it, it should be done quickly. The longer you wait, the more confident they get that they can attack safely. This meeting with Deep Throat produced the most serious disagreement between Bernstein and Woodward since they had begun working together 7 months earlier. The question was whether a convincing and well-documented account of Mitchell's and Colson's roles could be written. Woodward drafted a story based on the following lead. Federal investigators concluded that former Attorney General John N. Mitchell and Charles W. Colson, special counsel to the president, both had direct knowledge of the overall political espionage operation conducted by the men indicted in the Watergate case, according to reliable sources. Bernstein reworked the story three times, detailing virtually everything they had learned in 7 months about Mitchell, Colson, and the nature of the federal investigation. Its thrust was that a former attorney general and a special counsel to the president had escaped prosecution as conspirators because they had insulated themselves well, and because the investigations had been tailored to define the conspiracy in the narrowest terms. Each time Bernstein completed a version, Woodward said he didn't think it should run until they had better proof. Bernstein argued that the story was legitimate, that the newspaper didn't have to offer definitive evidence, but, in this instance, could report the conclusions of investigators, who reached as high as L. Patrick Gray. The argument became so heated that they would occasionally retreat to the vending machine room off the newsroom floor and shout at each other. Bernstein accused Woodward of playing into the hands of the White House by holding back on the story. Woodward accused Bernstein of the same, by trying to push a story into the paper that could lead to a damaging attack by the White House. But the old rule applied. If either objected to a story, it did not go into the paper. Shortly after his meeting with Deep Throat, Woodward got a call from the office of Senator Sam J. Ervin of North Carolina, a 76-year-old constitutional scholar and a formidable power on Capitol Hill. Ervin wanted to talk about Watergate, an aide said. On January 11th, Ervin had acceded to Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield's request that he preside over a thorough investigation of Watergate and the 1972 presidential campaign. The agreement seemed to indicate that some investigative machinery would be established on Capitol Hill beyond the preliminary inquiry that Senator Edward M. Kennedy's Judiciary Subcommittee on Administrative Practice and Procedure had been conducting since October 1972. Unless a congressional subcommittee quickly exercised power of subpoena to obtain records and documents in areas that the federal investigators seemed to be ignoring, Kennedy had told Bernstein in an interview just after the Segretti stories had appeared, the opportunity for a truly comprehensive investigation would probably go down the chute and into the shredder. Kennedy had decided to undertake an investigation. The senator had professed to know little, if anything, more than what he had read in the papers. But I know the people around Nixon, he said, and that's enough. They're thugs. The White House was circulating the line that Kennedy was out to settle old grudges and launch a 1976 candidacy. Kennedy, face tanned and his hair doing a little backflip over his collar, tossed it back. His inquiry would be a holding action. The preliminary investigation would be conducted by both the majority and the minority staffs behind closed doors. It would avoid any suggestion of a witch hunt or a Kennedy crusade. There was no percentage in it for him, Kennedy maintained. The White House would go with everything it had to smear him. Chappaquiddick would be brought up endlessly. He was sure the president's men had a ready store of other information on him. Nickel-and-dime stuff, he said, uncomfortably. They haven't come up with anything really new. When Kennedy's subcommittee formally began its investigation, the reporters tried to stay in close touch with the senators and their staff. But Kennedy's ship didn't leak. They learned nothing. Woodward hoped to do better with Senator Ervin, but the senator was more interested in finding out what Woodward and Bernstein knew. On the way into Ervin's inner office, Woodward noticed on a secretary's desk a typed sheet of paper listing the senator's appointments for the day. Cy Hirsch of the New York Times had been there several hours earlier. Woodward wondered how Hirsch had handled the situation. When was a reporter justified in turning over information to an investigating committee? Or giving advice to a senator? If the reporter was convinced that he could not make use of a valuable piece of information, was it all right to make a trade? Bernstein and he seemed to be running out of steam. Could their information help others in the search? Senator Ervin was sitting behind a heavy wooden desk in the center of his office, a rumpled, hulking figure with a huge ham of a face. He looked as if he would be more comfortable in a front porch rocker than in the standard-issue beige swivel chair he overfilled. Great heaps of paper were strewn chaotically across the desk. He leaned back and began speaking, head jerking, jowls jiggling, bushy eyebrows twittering, like some great bird of prey trying to lift off without losing his kill. The moment of truth arrived after a few minutes of gracious comments. "Any leads or sources of information you might be willing to share with us, it certainly would be appreciated and held in the strictest of confidence. I give you my word on that. We'd be mighty grateful for your help," Ervin said. Information from Deep Throat and Z and some other bits and pieces might help the investigation. Conceivably, could even send it on its way, Woodward thought. But he couldn't give it. The best he could do would be to suggest possible lines of inquiry. Identifying sources, he told the senator, was out of the question. There was one person, not necessarily a source, who had told them he would cooperate with any legitimate investigation. Hugh Sloan. A staff member wrote it down. The reporter's stories, Woodward continued, contained many names and incidents that needed more checking. The key was the secret campaign cash, and it should all be traced. Every indication pointed toward a massive Haldeman undercover operation, of which the Watergate break-in and the dirty tricks of the 72 primaries were only parts. Unless one of the seven convicted conspirators decided to cooperate, nothing resembling the whole story would come out. The reporter's own stories had only scratched the surface. They didn't completely comprehend what had happened, and was still happening, but the enormity of what the president's men had done seemed staggering. "I'll be content if we discover Mr. Magruder's role," Ervin said wearily. "The senator is an expert on the government's vandalism of people's rights, especially the right of privacy." Ervin began talking about the separation of powers, his belief that a certain article and certain section of the Constitution meant exactly what it said about the power of Congress. That, he said, was how he intended to investigate Watergate, by getting a resolution passed that would grant a special select committee the broadest possible subpoena power. Then the committee would subpoena whatever documents and people were necessary, in the executive branch and elsewhere. "Like whom?" Woodward asked. "Now, I believe that everyone who has been mentioned in your and Mr. Bernstein's accounts should be given an opportunity to come down and exonerate himself," Ervin said. "And if they decline, we'll subpoena them to ensure they have a chance to clear their names." He smiled, barely able to contain himself, as his eyebrows danced. "Even the CIA?" Elbows resting on the arms of his chair, Ervin gave a big affirmative nod. "And the White House? Haldeman?" That would be one for the books. The White House chief of staff hauled before the Congress he so despised. "Mr. Haldeman or Mr. Whomever," Irvin said. "Anybody but the president." He was serious. Woodward was sure the White House would be equally serious. The first question was whether a resolution granting such power could be passed. Irvin thought it could. Woodward asked if he could write that the senator planned to subpoena some of the president's top aides. "If you don't mention names and only say you know my thinking, I don't have any objection," Irvin said. "Just don't quote me directly." This conversation with Woodward was on background, but Senator Irvin later gave permission to be quoted in this book. Woodward wrote a story outlining Irvin's intention to summon the president's aides and to challenge the claim of executive privilege. The battle lines were being drawn. On February 5th, Senator Irvin introduced a resolution to allocate $500,000 for a Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities to investigate the Watergate break-in and related allegations. The powerful Senate Democratic Policy Committee had given the resolution its unqualified support, and the only impediment now would be a last-minute White House Republican maneuver. The day of the vote, February 7th, Woodward arrived on the Hill about 8:30 a.m. to see if one was developing. In the Senate cafeteria, he was chatting with the administrative assistant to a Republican senator. "What's the White House strategy?" Woodward asked. "What makes you think there is one?" the aide asked. "Don't know who thought up the idea," he added, "but there will be an amendment to broaden the investigation so that it covers the 64 and 68 campaigns." That figured. Politics as usual, not for the first time, would be the White House's response. "They're trying awfully hard," said another Republican aide. "Word came down to make a big push." Woodward called the White House from a phone booth in the press gallery. "Of course we're doing it," a source there told him. "You'd think those dolts on the Hill would have the sense to do it themselves. But they can't find their way to the John without help." "Haldeman's got half the staff here revved up on it. It's the order of the day. We're all supposed to make calls to people we know in the Senate." Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, the minority leader, rose to declare that Irvin had introduced the broadest resolution I've ever seen. He called its charter of authority wild, unbelievable, and said the resolution could lead to blackmail by members of the Senate Watergate Committee staff. There was wholesale evidence of wiretapping against the Republicans in the 1968 campaign, Scott charged, without citing it. John Tower of Texas and Barry Goldwater of Arizona joined in, but no one offered a concrete example or made a specific charge. The Democrats voted down every amendment to Irvin's resolution proposed by the minority. When the final vote was called, the Republicans joined their Democratic colleagues, and the resolution passed unanimously, 77-0. Veteran Senate reporters told Woodward that the unanimity was merely a Republican recognition of the power of the Democratic majority. Woodward wasn't so sure. The men on the floor were sharp interpreters of the political winds. Woodward was exhilarated. The system was showing signs of working. As he left the Capitol, he asked a Republican senator about a man he had noticed near the floor throughout the crucial tests on the amendments. "Oh," the senator said, "that was the Justice Department lawyer the White House sent over to draft the amendments." The trial, Z's statements, and the last meeting with Deep Throat had sent Woodward and Bernstein back to square one, Liddy and Hunt. If they could find out what Hunt and Liddy had done at the White House, and exactly what the plumber's mission entailed, perhaps they could understand why Hunt and Liddy were willing to go to jail. Several days after the Senate vote, Woodward headed for a luncheon appointment with a friend of Howard Hunt's at the Hay Adams Hotel. They met in the lobby and went into the main dining room. Woodward had been trying for months to get this man out to lunch. Now that he had finally succeeded, it wouldn't pay to push him too hard. His value as a source was incalculable now. Woodward ordered a beer and a hamburger. The characters in Hunt's novels were always ordering dishes Woodward had never heard of, and telling a chef how to prepare them. Hunt's friend, who seemed to share these gourmet tastes, asked the waiter how omelets were made at the Hay Adams. Woodward resisted, saying, "With eggs." The waiter checked with the kitchen and reported back. The answer was unsatisfactory. The man ordered braised lamb and broccoli with hollandaise, providing both were fresh. He then proceeded to make it clear that he thought Howard Hunt ridiculous. Once, during the Florida primary, Howard had some flyers printed saying that Mayor John V. Lindsay of New York was having a meeting and there would be free beer. Howard handed these flyers out in the black areas. And of course, there was no meeting or beer, so the blacks would come for their beer and leave hating Lindsay. Howard thought this was the greatest thing since Chinese checkers. The lamb arrived and was pronounced adequate. Now we know what Howard's wiretapping squad was really like. Just rank amateur. Well, he told me that he had developed a team of some really heavy people who could conduct electronic eavesdropping. Said they could install a sweep-proof bug that was voice-activated and could be picked up 100 yards away. You know, the Watergate bug was like a crystal set, powered with flashlight batteries. Heavy team, my ass. This hollandaise isn't fresh. He cast his fork angrily on the table and signaled the waiter. Since June 17th, Howard always refers to they when he talks about the White House and Watergate. They ordered me to leave town. They wanted this project. They ordered me to come back, etc. Howard accepted it. But Dorothy, Hunt's late wife, was furious and kept saying, "They ordered him to do this, and it's wrong for them to prosecute him." What projects had Hunt worked on for the White House? Woodward asked. Aside from Watergate? Well, Howard once made some vague references about going to... Where was it? Where was that woman on the ITT affair? Dita Baird. Where did she go? Denver, said Woodward. Yeah, Denver. Howard went to Denver. It was part of a White House project to show that the ITT memo was a forgery. Dita Baird was in the hospital there in Denver, and Howard went out to talk to her. What other projects? Not too long after he'd gone to work at the White House, Howard said that Colson and others had big plans to knock Ed Muskie out of the race, and he would be working on that, too. Hunt's friend was getting a little nervous. He suggested that they get to know each other better before any more information was passed on. What about research on Teddy Kennedy? Woodward asked. The reporters had already written about that last July. Right. Howard said that just after he went to work at the White House, he went to Massachusetts, the Boston area, I think, and saw a man who supposedly knew about Kennedy. I just can't remember the fellow's name. Howard went up there, and this guy supposedly knew about some of Kennedy's sexual escapades. Howard used his alias, Ed Warren, I remember that, and tape-recorded the interview with this guy. The man ordered a custard. And as he handed the menu to the waiter, he spilled his glass of water. He glared at the waiter as if it were his fault, and told him what the Hay Adams could do with its hollandaise. As they sipped coffee, he snapped his fingers. "Cliff DeMott," he said. "That was the guy in Boston that Howard saw. He works for the federal government there, some agency. D-E-M-O-T-T-E. Woodward spent the next 2 hours on the phone at the office trying to locate Cliff DeMott. He had the Boston operators check their directories twice, then began calling personnel locators at federal agencies. A woman in the GSA personnel office found it. Clifton DeMott, GS-12, a civil service ranking. The grades run from GS-1 to GS-18. Mott was assigned to the Navy Construction Battalion Center in Davisville, Rhode Island. Woodward reached DeMott early the next morning at work and guessed right. The FBI had interviewed DeMott after finding his number in Hunt's toll call records. "That's a confidential interview," DeMott said, sounding a little shaken. "I'm not supposed to talk about it with the press." Woodward said he already had most of the information and wanted to review it because the FBI got things screwed up so often. I didn't know it was Hunt at the time, DeMott said. He used the name Ed Warren. I didn't know it was Hunt until the FBI came and showed me pictures, and it sure was Ed Warren. But they said it was Hunt. DeMott, 41, had been public relations director for the Yachtsman Motor Inn in Hyannisport in 1960, when candidate John Kennedy had used the hotel as a press and staff headquarters for his presidential campaign. Hunt wanted to know if I'd heard of any woman chasing by the Kennedy boys, if I'd heard of any scandal-type material. He wanted me to do work on Chappaquiddick. He gave me a book to read, to see if it stirred my memory. It didn't. The book was Jack Olson's The Bridge at Chappaquiddick, the same one Hunt had checked out of the White House library. He had visited DeMott in July of 71, within a week or two of being hired at the White House. DeMott had provided Hunt with some strictly hearsay information about hell-raising by Kennedy staff members. It was old, from way back in 1956, DeMott said. John Kennedy had some real swinging parties and used state police cars to transport these people. Once they sent a police car to get a restock of booze. I tried to persuade Hunt that it was a waste of his time, but he said he represented some group that he couldn't tell me about. He said he was a writer. I thought he was a hell of a James Bond operator. We had supper and a drink in the motel. He seemed dedicated to something, either the country, the group, or himself. I spent a restless night and tried to find him in the morning for a cup of coffee, but he was gone. The Post's edition for February 10th carried a story saying that Howard Hunt had investigated Edward Kennedy's personal life during a period when the White House most feared a Kennedy candidacy. This time, Bradley did not hesitate to put the story on page one. Another apparent indication of the seriousness with which the Nixon forces viewed the threat of a Kennedy candidacy had come to the reporters about 1 month earlier. Woodward received a call from a woman who said she and a friend had bet an expensive dinner on whether Howard Hunt had been arrested inside the Watergate. He hadn't, which meant that the woman had won the bet. She invited Woodward to share the dinner. He declined. About 10 days later, the woman visited him in the office. A retired Army major had told her that in March of 1972, at a Republican campaign headquarters in the Washington area, he saw two campaign commercial spots that had Teddy Kennedy with a buxom blonde sitting on his lap. The woman was spliced or dubbed in. The woman said the retired major's name was Morrison J. Hosley and that he owned a general store in upstate New York. The next day, Woodward reached Hosley by phone.
"Yeah, I saw some cuts about 7 months ago that were to be shown in the last 10 days of the campaign, if Kennedy were on the ticket. The cuts looked dubbed. There was no realness to them. You had to put it together in your mind like the anti-Goldwater ads in 64, the ones showing a child walking in the grass and then shifting to a nuclear explosion. Kennedy was shown speaking, and then there would be this big-breasted woman on the screen. It would make good TV. But I'm not going to tell you if I saw them in a Republican headquarters or not. You better drop it."
Woodward called him back several days later and was told,
"I'm going to say I never told you anything. That it wasn't me who said there's a doctored film. Your source has gone dry."
Then Bernstein tried.
"What I saw, that's history," Hosley said. "I saw a print of it, but maybe I don't want you to have that information."
The DeMott story was only a small step in establishing what Hunt and Liddy had done at the White House. The reporters were more interested in Hunt's trip to see Dita Beard in Denver. She was the author of the famous memo which showed that there was a connection between ITT's promise of several $100,000 to help the Republican convention and a favorable antitrust settlement. Several days after his lunch with Hunt's friend, Woodward went to the Justice Department for a cup of coffee and some Watergate conversation. After an hour, Woodward asked about Hunt's Denver trip. Some ground had already been cleared. The Long Island paper Newsday had just reported that Chuck Colson had sent Hunt to visit Mrs. Beard at a hospital in Denver at the height of the ITT scandal in 1972. Newsday had no explanation for the trip.
The Justice Department official walked across the room to a file cabinet and took out a manila folder. He opened it and began reading. Under oath, Colson had acknowledged to Watergate prosecutors that he had sent Hunt to Denver just before March 17, 1972, to visit Dita Beard. The official was reading from a deposition the prosecutors had taken from Colson in private to spare the president's special counsel the embarrassment of appearing before the grand jury, he said. Woodward tried to disguise his surprise. Fortunately, the man was studying another section of the deposition. He looked up at Woodward meekly. Colson was never asked the reason he sent Hunt to see her. He said it had nothing to do with Watergate, so the matter was dropped. But Hunt used the same alias he used in Watergate, Edward Hamilton, when he saw her in the hospital. And he wore... You're not going to believe this. The official gave a little laugh. He wore a cheap dime-store reddish-colored wig. Apparently it was the same wig found in the Watergate Hotel the day after the arrests. At the office that evening, Woodward read the clips on the ITT affair. On February 29, 1972, columnist Jack Anderson had published the Dita Beard memo, sending political shockwaves through the White House during President Nixon's visit to China. On March 17th, just after Colson had dispatched Hunt to Denver, Mrs. Beard issued a statement from her bed at the Rocky Mountain Osteopathic Hospital in Denver, disowning the memo as a forgery and a hoax. Her statement that evening was the first suggestion that the memo was not genuine. But there was no explanation of why she had waited almost 3 weeks to disavow it, during which time Richard Kleindienst's nomination as Attorney General was thrown into doubt. Mrs. Beard had previously confirmed the memo's authenticity, line by line, to Anderson's assistant, Britt Hume. Woodward found three persons who put her denial into a new context. A White House official, a Republican politician with close ties to the White House, and an executive of the private investigative agency, Intertel. All told essentially the same story. Colson had coordinated the United White House ITT strategy. Initially, both the administration and the corporation had tried to picture Dita Beard as a drunken crackpot and sought to discredit Jack Anderson. The effort had failed. ITT had hired Intertel, which also did work for the Howard Hughes organization, to make a technical inspection of the memo. Intertel established that the memo was probably written on a typewriter in Mrs. Beard's downtown Washington office, but that it would be almost impossible to prove. Robert Bennett, who represented Howard Hughes' interests in Washington, passed this information on to Howard Hunt, his employee, for transmission to Colson. It was the old insulation story. Intertel's findings had cleared the way for the memo to be labeled a forgery. Colson, Hunt's other employer, dispatched Hunt to Denver. Mrs. Beard then issued a statement denying she had written the memo. I, and in a greater sense the whole American government, are the victims of a cruel fraud. Her words got back to the White House from Hunt to Bennett to Colson. It was like Tinker to Evers to Chance. Colson, Chance, then flipped the good news to Hugh Scott, who read Mrs. Beard's denial on the Senate floor that same day. There was one other person who could tell Woodward more about what had gone on. But Dita Beard was nowhere to be found. Woodward reached her attorney, who said he would pass questions on to Mrs. Beard. A few hours later, the attorney called back to say that Mrs. Beard had recently suffered a relapse of the heart ailment that had sent her to the hospital in the midst of the ITT affair. Woodward recalled that she had also suffered a relapse in the midst of her bedside questioning by senators from the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1972. Shortly before the attorney's call, Woodward had reached Mrs. Beard's 24-year-old son, Robert, in Denver. Woodward asked if he recalled a visit to his mother by Howard Hunt. Beard said that a mysterious man wearing a cheap wig and makeup had visited his mother in the hospital just before she issued her statement. From pictures I've seen, it could have been Howard Hunt, but I couldn't tell. The man refused to identify himself. He seemed to have inside information about what would happen next. He was very eerie. He did have a red wig on, cockeyed, as if he'd put it on a dark car. I couldn't have identified my brother like that. Beard added that he would give his mother a message to call Woodward back. If Robert Beard knew of a new relapse, he didn't mention it. Shortly before deadline the next evening, Woodward read Gerald Warren the text of a two-column re-examination of the Dita Beard affair based on the new information. The reopening of the ITT controversy, so long after the White House had thought the matter disposed of, left the president's men uncharacteristically speechless for the moment. Warren took 3 hours to say, "No comment." Colson was in Russia on a trade mission junket. The next day, Robert G. Kaiser, the Post correspondent in Moscow, found Colson and told him about the story. "That's a good one," Colson said, flashing a grin and walking away. If the reporters were to learn what else Hunt and Liddy had done at the White House, they would need more on the plumbers. The first step was to study Eagle Bud Krogh. Bernstein had met Krogh once at a ribbon-snipping ceremony. Krogh at the time was the president's advisor on national capital affairs. He jogged around the Ellipse in a sweatsuit before he went to work mornings. So Bernstein had asked him why the administration couldn't find room in the district budget to build some paths for cycling and jogging. Krogh had made a sympathetically bureaucratic reply about priorities. He had seemed like a nice enough fellow. Kind of bland, Bernstein had thought. Nice was an understatement, the reporters learned as they searched for an explanation of why Krogh had hung around with the likes of Hunt and Liddy. Eagle Krogh was the White House Mr. Clean, so straight and narrow that his friends mockingly called him Evil Krogh. He had been a member of John Ehrlichman's law firm in Seattle. Then he had served on the White House domestic counsel staff and coordinated the Nixon administration's worldwide war against drug trafficking. At 33, Krogh had become the youngest undersecretary in the Nixon cabinet, at Transportation, appointed in February 1973. Woodward placed a call to Capitol Hill to learn if the record of Krogh's confirmation hearing contained any leads. It didn't. But a congressional investigator who had worked on the hearing provided Woodward with the names of some of Krogh's friends and acquaintances. The reporters started calling. Soon there was a break. Bud said that Hunt and Liddy were being routed information from national security wiretaps, Woodward was told. Krogh's friend could recall no details. Krogh had mentioned it shortly after Hunt and Liddy had been indicted. Working from a 1972 White House telephone directory, the reporters started calling the people under Ehrlichman's jurisdiction. One former and one current member of the White House staff provided identical versions of the next link in the chain. David Young, the former appointment secretary to Dr. Henry Kissinger and Krogh's deputy on the Plumbers Project, had regularly routed transcripts of wiretap conversations to Hunt and Liddy in 1971 and 1972. Both sources thought that reporters and those suspected of leaking information to them might have been tapped. Woodward called Kathleen Chenow, the plumbers' ex-secretary, and asked about the tapped data Young had forwarded to Hunt and Liddy. "I can't talk about that," she said now. The wiretapping activities, actual and suspected, of the Nixon administration had always been controversial. Under the administration's national security wiretap policy, also known as the Mitchell Doctrine, the president's men had claimed unprecedented authority to conduct electronic surveillance. Until the Supreme Court declared it illegal on June 19, 1972, 2 days after the Watergate arrests, the Justice Department had used electronic eavesdropping without court authorization against those suspected of domestic subversive activity. Radicals and civil libertarians had long insisted that the term subversive was a euphemism for those who dissented too vigorously from the Nixon administration's policies. Now the reporters attempted to learn if their colleagues in the news media were among the subversives the Justice Department had claimed the right to listen in on. Judging from the reception their inquiries received, they were coming close to something. Some officials were less than convincing in their denials. Others refused to discuss it, and some admitted they shared the reporters' suspicions. The reporters had reached a dead end.
Woodward drafted a story based on the bare details. It reported that Hunt and Liddy had received information from national security wiretaps, that it was routed to them by David Young, Dr. Kissinger's assistant, who was also a plumber. The story noted that the plumbers were in the business of investigating news leaks. Readers were left to form their own conclusions. This time, too, Gerald Warren took a few hours to answer with the White House's one-sentence denial. After thorough checking, we can find absolutely no basis for the report. Tiring of the game, Woodward asked him if that was a flat denial. Warren, who became cold and formal in such situations, said, "I can't say anything else," and appealed for understanding. The article noted that Warren had not flatly denied the report. 2 weeks later, Time magazine published the first detailed account of the Nixon administration's zealous campaign to trace news leaks by tapping the telephones of news reporters and government officials. According to the Time account, the phones of half a dozen reporters and twice as many White House and government aides had been tapped by the FBI for reasons of domestic security. The taps were begun in 1969 under a reluctant J. Edgar Hoover, and were continued under his successor, acting FBI Director L. Patrick Gray III, until the Supreme Court decision of June 19, 1972. Hoover, said Time, had permitted his agents to install the taps only after John Mitchell authorized each tap in writing. In 1971, when the administration had tried to force Hoover to retire, Time said, the old bulldog-faced director had successfully resisted by threatening to reveal the details of the wiretapping campaign. On February 26th, the day Time's edition hit the newsstand, Bernstein spent the morning at Justice trying to confirm the details. Chasing from office to office after Time's work on this one was less than fun. Bernstein got nowhere and took a cab back to the office. Dejected, he stepped into the elevator in the post lobby and suddenly felt his arm grabbed and then his body being pulled back into the lobby. He started to struggle, then heard a female voice. "Boy, am I glad to see you." It was Laura Kiernan, a young news aide who had recently been promoted to reporter on the local staff. "There's a guy upstairs in the newsroom with a subpoena for you and your notes. Bradley doesn't want you up there to get it. He wants you out of here, fast." Bernstein dashed to a stairwell at the end of the lobby, then up 7 flights of stairs to the accounting department. Closing the door of an office with an adding machine on the desk, he dialed Bradley's extension. Woodward was off for a few days in the Caribbean, but they had long before agreed on what to do if they were subpoenaed. Turning over notes or naming sources in either a grand jury proceeding or a judicial hearing was obviously out of the question. There would be plenty of time to fight that in court. The first thing to do was move their files to a safe place. Bernstein told Bradley where the files were. They would be moved immediately, he said. CRP had issued subpoenas for 5 people at the Post. Bernstein, Woodward, Jim Mann, who had worked on some of the initial Watergate stories, Howard Simons, and Katherine Graham. Also reporters from the Star News, the New York Times, and Time magazine. Simons and Mrs. Graham, the only non-reporters on CRP's list, had already been served. The subpoenas demanded that those served testify by deposition in CRP's civil suit and bring with them all notes, tapes, and story drafts in their possession regarding Watergate. Bradley told Bernstein he couldn't find the Post's lawyers, and he didn't want him served until he'd heard their advice. "Get out of the building," he said. "Go to a movie and call me at 5 o'clock." Bernstein went to see Deep Throat, the movie version. When he called at 5, Bradley told him to return to the office and explained the strategy. Bernstein would accept the subpoena. Custody of at least some of the reporter's notes would pass to Mrs. Graham. "Of course, we're going to fight this one all the way up. And if the judge wants to send anyone to jail, he's going to have to send Mrs. Graham. And my God, the lady says she'll go. Then the judge can have that on his conscience.
Can't you see the pictures of her limousine pulling up to the woman's detention center? And out gets our gal, going to jail to uphold the First Amendment. That's a picture that would run in every newspaper in the world. There might be a revolution.
That night, Bernstein was at his desk, typing, when he saw the CRP page hurrying down the middle aisle, arm outstretched. Bernstein continued to type.
Carl Bernstein?
Head down, Bernstein raised one hand and picked off the subpoena. But the page stood there silently. Finally, Bernstein glanced up from the typewriter. The page looked about 21, tousled blonde hair, wearing a V-necked sweater, very collegiate.
"Hey, I really feel bad about doing this," he said. "They picked me because they thought somebody who looked like a student could get upstairs easier."
He was a law student who worked part-time at the firm headed by Kenneth Wells Parkinson, the chief CRP attorney. He promised to keep alert for any information that might be useful to the Post and gave Bernstein his home phone number.
Chapter 13. After Woodward returned from the Caribbean later that week, a short, heavy-set young man with a thin beard wringing his face and wearing small, thick glasses arrived in front of his desk.
"Tim Butts,"
he said conspiratorially. He had once worked in Army intelligence, he said. Now he worked with a volunteer group of ex-intelligence types that was investigating people involved in domestic spying activities.
"I think we found a George Washington University student who spied for CRP," Butts said. "It'll take some more work."
He told Woodward a rather disjointed tale. Woodward urged him to continue his researches and received almost a dozen telephoned progress reports in the next several days. After about a week, Butts called and said he had found a fraternity brother of the student spy who was willing to tell all. A dinner meeting was set that night in the coffee shop of the Madison Hotel. When Woodward arrived, Butts was pacing the lobby with a young man he introduced as his source, a tall, nervous-looking student named Craig Hilligas. The three went to a booth. Hilligas described in vivid detail how Theodore F. Brill, his Kappa Sigma fraternity brother, had told him about being paid $150 a week by CRP to infiltrate the group of Quakers who had maintained a 24-hour-a-day vigil in front of the White House for several months. Brill's assignment had been to make regular reports to CRP on the personal lives and plans of the demonstrators, he said, and then to assist in setting them up for arrests on drug charges. Eventually, the Washington police raided the vigil, but found nothing. Brill, 20, was chairman of the Young Republicans at George Washington University. His job at CRP was terminated 2 days after the Watergate arrests. "The idea," Hilligas said, thumping his water glass excitedly on the table, "was to create an embarrassment to the Democrats, because any embarrassment to radical groups would be considered an embarrassment to liberal politics and Senator McGovern." With unrestrained gusto, he went on to describe the James Bond way in which Brill was paid. "Ted said he once was told to meet a woman in a red dress with a white carnation carrying a newspaper. He exchanged his written report for an envelope containing his pay. Another time, Ted told me, he went to a bookstore on the corner of 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue and was handed a book by someone with his pay in the book. But it was part of a larger network. Ted said there were at least 25 others, and the information went to some pretty high-up people at CRP. Woodward was mindful of Harry Rosenfeld's continuing pleas to find more of the 50 spies mentioned in the October 10th Segretti story. "Where are the other 49? Rosenfeld would ask every week or two, though perhaps 25 had surfaced by that time. Theodore Brill didn't seem exactly like a big-time operator, but if his fraternity brother was telling the truth, he was part of the pattern. George Washington University, 5 blocks from the White House, was on spring vacation. The next night, Woodward reached Theodore Brill at his home in River Edge, New Jersey. Playing the heavy with a 20-year-old history major made Woodward uneasy, but Brill might be one of those unexpected openings to something bigger. Eventually, Brill confirmed his fraternity brother's story and added a few details. He had been hired and paid by George K. Gorton, 25, CRP's National College Director. I was paid 5 weeks in May and June, once in cash and 4 times